Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, what's cracking? Welcome to the Daily Jungle. The Canelo versus Triple G rematch is up in the air after Canelo failed a PED test and blamed it on, wait for it, bad beef. The Steelers plan on slapping their franchise tag on Le'Veon Bell, and Le'Veon Bell is not happy about that. Plus, Gym Guy took maxing out to a new level over the weekend and blew his face out, literally. Chief Safety Eric Berry and I had an excellent conversation. It was so good to finally run him down. Robert Klemko of the MMQB joined me to talk about the Combine. Turner Sports analyst Steve Lavin joined us as well, and we talked some March Madness. The Daily Jungle starts right now. I want to start with some boxing. A little bit unusual, right? But when it's the guy we're talking about and the fight we're talking about, it's a convenient place to start. Of course, I'm talking of Canelo Alvarez. He tests positive for PED ahead of his May fight with Triple G. It was announced yesterday that he had failed not one but two tests for clenbuterol last month, and that May 5th rematch might now be in jeopardy. Now, if you're not up on your bronchial dilators that also double as PEDs, here is a quick refresher on the clenbuterol. Victor Conte, and he would know, he told Yahoo Sports it, quote, helps to retain muscle or build muscle and burns body fat, which is exactly what a bodybuilder wants, end quote. Yeah, and obviously it might be a little helpful to a boxer as well, right? Yeah, I know. A boxer on PEDs. No way. Shocking, right? First it was curlers, and now it is boxers. Where does it all end? Like, the only thing less shocking than an athlete testing positive for a PED is an athlete failing to take responsibility for testing positive for a PED, which is pretty much exactly what Canelo's camp did by, wait for it, blaming the PED on beef. Golden Boy Productions said the test results, quote, were consistent with meat contamination that has impacted dozens of athletes in Mexico over the last years. End of quote. In other words, the clenbuterol is not in his system because he was looking for an edge, but because he was looking for a steak. That PED that showed up on the test result is not there because Canelo was looking for lean muscle, but because he was looking for a lean porterhouse. I'll play along. Maybe that is the case. Maybe he really did stumble into some clenbuterol cow. He would not be the first guy to test positive or fail a PED test because of tainted beef, allegedly. In fact, the old tainted beef excuse is one of the oldest in the book. But if it really is the case, isn't that convenient? I mean, awfully convenient and awfully close to the biggest fight of his entire career. His camp is saying that the amounts of the test were so low, it could only come from bad beef. Again, maybe. Maybe that's the case. Or maybe it means that it had been a while since he'd been using that PED, and that's why there were only trace amounts. That's why the amount was so low. Either way, more investigation is needed, and Canelo better be prepared to prove and show exactly when and where he slammed that bad beef. Which restaurant served him that bad beef? What store sold him that bad beef? You know, as opposed to some roid head out in the alley outside of his gym. Show me the paper trail leading to the bad meat. Now, for his part, Canelo released a statement, quote, I'm an athlete who respects the sport, and this surprises me and bothers me because it had never happened to me. I will submit to all the tests that require me to clarify this embarrassing situation, and I trust at the end the truth will prevail, end quote. Yeah, just because it never happened to him doesn't mean he hadn't done it. And embarrassing is not the right word. Moronic is. Dumb is. Because here is the truth that should have prevailed in the first place. If you know that clenbuterol is put into beef in Mexico and China because it produces leaner meat, which it does, and if you know that athletes have failed PED tests in the past, allegedly due to this meat, then don't eat the meat. Very simple. Not complicated. Here's something else that's not complicated. You're a pro athlete. You're responsible for everything that you put into your body. At least you're supposed to be. And if it's something that's impacted dozens of athletes in Mexico over the last several years, as your camp says, then you don't do it. There's no excuse for that, especially if it's already known. And it is. You had to know the risk was there, and you still took it. Why? For what? Listen, I want to be clear about this. I'm not saying that Canelo definitely, knowingly took a PED as part of a cycle. Just as those side-by-side pics of him during a weight cut and fully inflated is not evidence that he did or didn't either. But you should look at those pictures. But even then, I'm not going to visually indict somebody. But at the very minimum, a failed PED test for a very avoidable reason is pretty lame. And to just roll on and act like it's okay because he had a bad steak is not good enough. It's more than embarrassing. At the very best, it's stupid. And at the very worst, it's a lot worse. And one other problem here. Even if he is telling the truth, even if it is bad beef and it's not PEDs, there are always going to be people who think that he did roid up or does roid up. There will always be people who never buy the tainted beef defense. And then if he wins that fight, those same exact people are going to say he won because he cheated. That not only is the beef tainted, but so is his win because he cheats. So even if he wins, in the eyes of many, he still loses, even if he did nothing wrong but slam a tainted beef sando. And the guy's got nobody to blame but himself for that. Again, if you know there are cases of tainted beef in Mexico and China, then maybe you don't eat the beef in those places. Especially if you already know. Eric Berry. Eric, it is great to have you on the show. How are you?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. It's great to be here.
Eric, it is great to have you here. I appreciate it very much. Hey, listen, I had Cliff Averill on the show yesterday, and we talked about the pro athlete business combine that both of you participated in recently. There are a lot of things, Eric, that you might be doing with your time in the offseason. What made it, or what was it that made you want to get involved in the combine?
Man, it just looked like a great investment and opportunity. It was brought to me by my player engagement rep, BJ. And he knows Caleb Thornhill very well, who also works in the same position, but only with the Dolphins. But I was looking at the invitation and looking at the people who were going to be present, and it seemed like something I couldn't miss, man. Like I built some great relationships with some business owners, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and, I mean, it's been great so far. Like I've been in communication with them since I've left the combine, and it's been going great.
So it sounds like there's a lot of good networking going on. So, like, what was your biggest takeaway from that experience?
Man, my biggest takeaway from the experience was definitely seeing that we have the same skills and talents that they have. You know, and I think with ATU and doing this business combine, it kind of showed us how we could transition and move those skills that we've developed on the field in a whole different arena and be able to transition it into a business world or anything that we want to get involved with. And I think us building those relationships, not only with the, you know, the Jesse Islers or the Jesse Islers or, you know, the Ben Mosses, the great business leaders, we did that with amongst ourselves. Like you said, you had Cliff on the show yesterday, and me and him talked a bit about what he has going on. And I heard a lot of great things that he has going on, especially back in Haiti, you know, just giving back to the place where he's from and being able to have that ecosystem where I can, you know, reach out to somebody from a different team and a different background and see what they're going through or bounce ideas that I may have off with them and possibly getting involved in some things together. So we're just building those relationships, and I think right now they're working on getting us a different location next year to possibly go out to L.A., around your area, neck of the woods, or possibly into Silicon Valley.
Chief Safety Eric Berry joining us. I can tell you're fired up by that if you're already thinking about next year. Listen, you've got a lot of time left in your career, but when did you start thinking about life after football, and then what kind of thoughts do you have right now? What do you think you might want to do once your football career is over?
Man, you know, I've always thought about it because my mom, she was big on me just making sure I always had a backup plan. And she at a young age told me that cosmetics and beauty products would never go out of style. So that's something that I always kept my eye on, something that I've always had in the lab, as well as fashion. And, I mean, I've just been constantly coming up with ideas and coming up with different concepts. And I actually was able to do a deep dive or an internship with Andrew Jane, who is a fashion designer in New York. So we actually created a collection under his brand, me and four other players, to so that he can pitch the Saks on today. So we actually had a deep dive that we came up with a whole collection, pitched the ideas, came up with the colors, the concept, and picked out the fabric right up the street from his office, looked at his whole operation, and also did some great things in the community as well. I think he fitted around 30 kids who he's going to create custom suits for at a YMCA. So I got to help him measure the kids and just give back. But at the same time, it was a great experience that I probably would have never been able to, never would have pushed myself this quickly to get into that type of environment. But it was something that I really appreciated.
I was about to say, what a great cause and what a great experience. The Daily Jungle is brought to you by a brand new sponsor, Burrow Furniture. Handcrafted in the USA, Burrow makes luxury couches for real life. Burrow is the same quality that you would expect from high-end retailers without breaking the bank. Plus, everything is customizable, and Burrow couches are even stain-resistant. So go ahead, eat your dinner on the couch. This couch fears no pizza. And there's a built-in USB charger for when your devices are in the red. Say goodbye to that extra long charge cord. That's incredible. Better yet, all Burrow furniture is easy to put together and take apart. No tools required, just your bare hands. Enjoy 30 days of naps on your Burrow risk-free. And if for any reason you choose not to keep it, the return process is simple. Go try a Burrow couch for yourself. Order today. It will ship in a jiffy. Use the promo code ROAM at Burrow.com and get $50 off your order. Once again, Burrow.com, offer code ROAM. Make sure it's in all caps. That's Burrow Furniture. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle. Chief Safety Eric Berry joining us. So you've got lots going on right now. I also saw, Eric, that you suffered that Achilles injury, of course, in the season opener, but I saw a video that was posted online, and you were working crazy to come back from it. How's that process going, and where are you at physically right now?
Right now, shoot, I'm doing everything I can possibly do. I'm running, I'm cutting, I'm lifting, getting stronger. And but at the same time, I'm being smart, making sure I don't overdo it. You know, I've been down this road before, but right now it's just all about doing things smart and making sure I'm making the right moves and right decisions.
You know, I wonder, Eric, when you've been through what you've been through, when you were diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease and then you suffer an injury like this to your Achilles, is there any part of you that at any point says, why me? Why me? Why is this happening to me? This isn't fair. Do you ever have those moments?
Not really. I mean, I first did when I first got diagnosed, and, you know, when the numbness, I was pretty much numb to the diagnosis for a little bit, but once it really hit me, yeah, I was in a state of why me. But and just looking back, like, even when I was going through cancer, it was still a privilege. That's one thing I also learned at the business combine. One of the speakers said that pressure is a privilege. And you should want that pressure because it's going to bring the best out of you. And at the same time, just looking at my situation, it's a lot of people out here in this world that's going through a lot worse things than a torn Achilles or just cancer. So I just give everything I have in the things that I can control. I mean, every day is a blessing, so you got to pretty much treat it that way.
Eric, I just want to follow up on what you just said. That's a really powerful statement. I mean, I could see where pressure is a privilege, but cancer is arguably the worst thing ever. How do you get to a point where you see cancer is a privilege?
So, I mean, if you break it down, like, everybody on the outside looking in, they just think it's cancer, cancer, cancer. And they never really, I mean, there's different levels to it. So my cancer, especially with my treatment, mine was very curable. You know what I'm saying? So all I had to do was stay consistent with my treatments and eat right and make sure I was staying in shape. And I was 25 when I also got diagnosed, so I was still young and healthy. And plus, I also had my family support. I had family support of my friends, support of the whole NFL, coaches, players, fans included. But at the same time, when I had to get my chemo treatments, there were also other people in the Bay, which is where we all get our treatments done. It was other people there. But, you know, I have different people with me. My mom and dad would sit in with me, or my brothers would come and visit me and sit in and communicate with me. Other people didn't have that. You know what I'm saying? Other people didn't have insurance to pay for their chemo treatments. Other people had to put up their houses for their chemo treatment. Some people didn't. Some people were older. Some people had been taking chemotherapy for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You know what I'm saying? So here it is. I just have one chemo treatment for once every 2 weeks for just a 6-month time period. So I got 12 total treatments. But some people just had it bad, man. And just understanding that they saw me and realized that I was doing well, it made them want to do better. So I just put the pressure on myself and just fought through it.
Eric Berry, my guest. Eric, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on that. I guarantee there are people listening right now who are dealing with something like that, or they know somebody who's dealing with something like that, that are hearing that message and they're getting inspiration from it. You know, which brings me to this point. I'm always looking for people who are energy givers, people who bring passion and inspiration. And a while back, Eric, I came across this video of a speech by Inky Johnson, who is a friend of yours from Tennessee. And in a game against Air Force, he suffered an injury making a tackle. His right arm was paralyzed. What do you remember about the first time you met Inky?
The first time I met Ink, man, like, I remember him giving this speech about him being, first of all, like, the team as a whole, we weren't working out at the level that he felt was appropriate. And just looking at the situation, that was my freshman year. It was 2007. He just called up everybody and pretty much told them that they was out there not giving everything they had. But the fire he had in his eyes, like, and, you know, he had already had his surgeries, his multiple surgeries, and he's standing up in front of the team telling them how he would, telling us how he would give anything to get back on the field, like anything. And here it is. I got 2 arms, 2 legs. I'm in good health. And, you know, I'm giving it everything I got. But at the same time, everybody in his view wasn't. So after he gave this big speech about how he would give everything, like he almost died for the game, and like it really just hit everybody. He gave this big speech, and after that we continued to work out, and he worked out next to me the whole time. You know what I'm saying? So like ladder drills, sprints, heels, he worked out next to me with one arm just to see if I would break or see if I would fold. And I knew I wasn't going to break or fold, but at the same time it forced me to push myself past comfort. And just having him right next to me and just to go through that whole workout after all he had been through. And mind you, just because his arm wasn't functioning, like he still had the sweetest feet work on the team. Huh. Like it was crazy. Like still explosive, still fast. He didn't get tired. He didn't bend over. He didn't even let me put my hands on my hips, even when, you know what I'm saying? Like when you're standing there, he wouldn't let me bend over, wouldn't let me stand. I mean, put my hands on my hips, couldn't hold my head down. I couldn't show any signs of weakness. And that's where he kind of pushed my game to the next level. But not even only in just a physical realm. He always challenged me mentally. You know, just what are my goals? What do I want to do? What do I want to do outside of football? What do I want to accomplish? How do I want to help other people? Like little things like that. And I think having him as a freshman in college, as a mentor, I think that's really what helped me develop so quickly.
You know, it's amazing, too, because that's not something that stayed with you, obviously, for 1 week, that game, that season. To this day, obviously, I can hear the way you talk about him, that message stayed with you. And let me ask you this, Eric, before you go. The team traded Marcus Peters. And I bring this up only because we don't know what goes on. We're not there. We don't know what's said. We don't know how a guy works, what a guy's like. And you would know better than us. What kind of a person is he? What kind of a teammate is he? And what is there about Marcus Peters maybe that people outside that facility don't know?
I think if he was your teammate, I think you would be honored to play next to him. You know what I'm saying? Especially in the secondary. In the secondary, you know, we put in tough situations. The only other group that's moving backwards is the offensive line. And we move backwards on every play. Like everybody else is moving forward, we're moving backwards. But to have him next to you, especially if I'm playing safety and he's a corner, like that's one of the things you love to have. You know, you can always depend on them. Like, everything's not going to be perfect, but you can understand that, man, if we going against whoever, you got somebody that's going to strap his helmet up and go and be ready to go, regardless of who the opponent is. And I was just – it was an honor for me to play next to him, you know what I'm saying? Like, even when I first met him, I think my first day of camp, we ended up first meeting. Like, that was the first time I met him. I had just got done with cancer and all that other stuff. And we ended up doing some extra drills after practice. And that was my first day meeting. And, like, man, honestly, man, he's one of the biggest. I think he's one of the best players I've ever played with. You know what I'm saying? Not just from a physical standpoint, but just what he tried to do in the community. Like, he's very big in the community. And I don't know, I think if somebody just could hear him out, and obviously he does have a little bit of growing up to do, but if somebody's willing to help him, like genuinely help him, I think he could probably be one of the best players to ever do it.
Eric Berry's a five-time Pro Bowler, a three-time first-team All-Pro. He was the team's Walter Payton Man of the Year nominee in 2015. All right, Eric, so the 2018 Pro Athlete Business Combine was in New York City. Do you think it's going to be in L.A. next year? And if it's in L.A., I'd love for you to swing right through here.
Man, we need to come out there. I know it's a few guys that would love to stop by the show and see what you have going on.
It is Tuesday, and it is tag day in the NFL. That means the franchise tags are being doled out. And that means that, barring a miracle, Le'Veon Bell is about to get hit with a franchise tag yet again. And barring a miracle, he is about to be pissed about that yet again. Now, this is not about a guy and a team not wanting each other. They want him. It's also not about a team that buys in but not fully. You know, not like the Redskins and Kirk Cousins that, yeah, we think you're pretty good, but we don't know if you're elite. Yeah, we think that you're solid, but we don't know that we want to do a multi-year contract because we're just not sold on you being a franchise guy. That's not what this is about. This is about them trying to decide on a number that makes sense. They want him, and if you go based on his tweet, he wants them. Le'Veon said, quote, "Pittsburgh, the city that took in a 21-year-old kid from small-town Ohio, the city I battled through adversity in, the city that I became a man in. I love everything about being a Pittsburgh Steeler, and I want nothing more than to finish the rest of my career in Pitt. Hashtag 26 forever." So this is not about that. They want each other. He wants to be there. They want him. This is about money. Specifically, the right number. Bell told ESPN, quote, "We're not coming to a number we both agree on. They're too low, or I guess they feel I'm too high. I'm playing for strictly my value to the team. That's what I'm asking. I don't think I should settle for anything less than what I'm valued at." Herein lies the problem. They see that value differently. They see him at a different value than he sees himself. He values himself at more than a one-year tag of $14.5 million. And he's got a point, especially when Antonio Brown and Ben Roethlisberger are making more than that. Because there is no denying Bell's impact. He's not just an every down back. He's an elite every down back. And he's an elite wide receiver. He's their number one back and their number two wide receiver. This is his point. He wants to be paid like that. Not like an elite back, but rather an elite back and their number two wide receiver. He wants to be paid like that, and in my opinion, he should be. He's got more yards from scrimmage last year. He averaged nearly 130 yards from scrimmage last year, which is more than anybody since 1970. So this guy's doing things that have not been done in decades. He wants to be paid like the top back in the NFL and is their number two receiver. Now the team's going to say, hold up now, hold up. Devontae Freeman is the highest paid running back in the NFL and we're offering you way more than he's getting. To which I'm sure Le'Veon Bell would say, hey, you know what? You can keep that guy's name out your mouth. He doesn't even play the same position I do. Nobody does because I don't have a position. I play every skill position. And you need to pay me like I do. And again, I think the guy's got a point. He's got a point. He is that good. So good, I don't even care what that number is. What his number is. He's pretty much worth it. Now, if you're a Steeler fan, the good news is, Bell says, quote, "This year, we are a lot closer than last year. In good spirit, I feel we can get something done. But unless something drastic changes, it won't be this week." End quote. Now, the bad news is that threat of him sitting out or retiring is still on the table, which I understand as well. Because of the NFL system and his position, this guy does not have a lot of leverage. And when you don't have the hammer, you have to make a hammer. And he's trying like crazy to make that hammer. The question is, would he actually swing it? Would he actually sit out or even retire if he doesn't get the number that he wants. Doubt that? In fact, I'd be shocked if he did that. And not because he's all talk. He's not. He said that he turned down a 3-year deal last year that would have been worth $42 million. One that he came very close to signing. One that even his mother wanted him to sign, but he turned it down again because he thought that's not where his value is. One thing to turn down a deal that the team offers you, another to turn down an offer that your mom likes with an organization and a city where you want to be. But there is a big difference between not signing a deal until right before the season and then not playing that season at all and not getting that cash at all. $14.5 million may not be what he wants. It may not be what he deserves, but it's a hell of a lot more than zero. And I don't see that guy leaving that stack on that table. You only have so many peak earning years. It can all be ripped from you in a single second, which is why he's pushing so hard for a multi-year deal and some security. So, while the Steelers would be smart to give it to him because there is no other player like him, they don't have to give it to him. And I just don't see this guy retiring or not playing this season in order to get what he wants. He's different, but not that different. And I'm not saying that he's not worth what he's asking for. I'm saying he's not leaving $14.5 million on the table if he doesn't get it. None of us would. And the good news is, this might be the tag day, but they still have about 6 months to come to an agreement on a long-term deal. And he says they're a lot closer this year than they were last year. So we'll see. I think the guy's worth it. The guy's no ordinary back. You know, and don't come in with, yeah, but what about Alvin Kamara? What about the fact that you can get guys like that in the third round? You can't. You can't get a guy like this in the third round because there is no other guy like this guy, which is his point. Robert Klemko is my guest. Robert, good to have you back, bud. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good. Good to visit. You know, from a distance, the combine looks like a really weird event. I mean, I'm not acting like this is the first time I've seen this, but think about this. You've got guys bench pressing 225 with hundreds of scouts watching in a room, millions more watching on TV. So what's it like to be actually there and to cover the combine in person?
You know, it's interesting because these teams spend more and more money every year and the staffs get bigger and bigger. And for a lot of the year, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you have guys who are in many ways embedded at the schools that they're covering. And you ask him about, you know, the second string tackle at Oklahoma, and he's heard something about him, and he's got a smart take, right? So that's why you pay those guys to do that. But then you invite them all to the combine, and there's just not a lot for them to do. So you end up having 150 guys watching players bench press and trying to get something out of that, and when there's really nothing to gain there. It's an odd thing.
It's a really odd thing. And meanwhile, we can't stop watching it, and we can't take our eyes off it. Let me ask about Lamar Jackson. You talk about an odd thing. Here's a guy that threw for more than 9,000 yards at Louisville. He won the 2016 Heisman Trophy. Yet multiple teams are asking him or asked him to work out as a wide receiver. When you first saw that, what was your reaction?
Well, you know, I can't sit here and say that Lamar Jackson isn't better suited as a wide receiver in the NFL. But his resume as a passer, as you mentioned, is incredible. And we understand that some of the most prolific passers in college football, their game doesn't necessarily translate. But I think it's also pretty fair to say, when you just look at the history of guys who have been asked to make a position switch, that there's a lower threshold for a talented black quarterback to be asked to make that switch than there is for a white quarterback. I mean, we've had guys like Jeff Driscoll come through the league and just completely struggle at Florida, have to transfer to Louisiana Tech, really not have an impressive season there. And these guys are big, strong, athletic, and they don't get asked to change positions until all else fails. Whereas we have a Heisman winner in Lamar Jackson, who's passed for over 9,000 yards, and the biggest question he faces at the combine is whether or not he should take snaps at wide receiver. I think there's a very obvious bias there, and I think we feed into it sometimes in the media by asking black quarterbacks if they'll make that switch and not asking athletic white quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, why is that exactly? I mean, Driscoll, as you point out, this guy, for instance, he had a 4.56 40 and a 10-foot, 2-inch broad jump. Connor Shaw, for instance, ran a 4.66 40 and had a 34-inch vert. but they were never offered the chance to try out a wide receiver or tight end. So why do you think nobody asked those guys to work out a different position, but people are quick to say Lamar Jackson? You know, this is something you probably should think about.
I think inherently evaluators, in a lot of the cases, guys that, you know, you wouldn't call prejudice, that you'd be happy going to have a beer with, from the college recruiting level all the way up to the NFL, look at a black player and say that player has a lot more athletic potential than another white player. So even if that player has accomplished all of this as a quarterback, if you see flaws in his game, I think the tendency for a lot of these people is to imagine what else they could be. And in other cases, I think that with African-American quarterbacks, they often aren't described with the same leadership characteristics that we describe white quarterbacks with. I mean, Lamar Jackson at Louisville was just as much the leader and just as much the Pied Piper of, you know, that program, and worked just as hard and had just as much control over his offense as Josh Rosen or Baker Mayfield. And, you know, just because he may interview poorly and can't sit down with an NFL team and explain in 5 minutes the depths of his offense, that doesn't mean he can't learn and he can't develop. All of these players like Shaw and Driscoll and Chad Kelly, guys who are athletes, they get a chance to go to an NFL roster and develop. But we start questioning the black quarterbacks immediately.
Robert Klemko, NFL columnist for the MMQB and Sports Illustrated, joining us. All right, Robert, you mentioned Baker Mayfield. Let me move on to that for a minute. I had Mark Andrews from Oklahoma on the show yesterday. We talked about his comments to you about how fired up he was to tell every team about Baker Mayfield and what he's like as a teammate. So coming out of Indy, what's your sense of how the combine went for Mayfield and the impression that he left on teams?
You know, I think it went really positive. I think that there's a limited amount of throws that they do at the combine as opposed to the pro day. So I think a lot of teams are waiting to make judgments on some of these NFL throws, these deep corners, deep intermediate routes, go balls from the pocket, that they didn't see him make a lot at Oklahoma. They want to see that stuff at the pro day. But, you know, he did well enough in the throwing at the combine. He was happy with his performance. But what I really, my big takeaway from it was that a lot of teams came away really impressed with how he handled the interview portion, specifically the teams that would ask him or tell him, hey, here's a play, here's all the options on this play, here's your read, here's your protection, here's how we attack it versus cover two, man, cover three. And then they'd ask him all kinds of questions about his personal life, you know, his arrest and a year ago, just anything to throw him off. And then at the end of the 15 minutes, they say, hey, read us back that play. And I heard from one team that said that he read it back better than any of the other quarterbacks that they interviewed. And this is a team in the top 10 that's going to be picking high and probably picking a quarterback. So I think teams are beginning to realize just his football knowledge, his football acumen, and how quickly he may actually be ready to play in the NFL.
Robert Klemko joining us, talking about what he saw at the combine. Meantime, Browns GM John Dorsey said, the door is open if another team wants to trade up for the number one pick. I mean, dude, what's going on?
Sorry, my alarm just went off.
You got it, man. You're late. All right, so listen, is this any different than any other team and what they would do and what they would say if they had that first pick? Or do you think the Browns really are motivated to make a deal involving that first pick?
I think every team who has the number one pick will say this. I think the Browns are especially motivated to actually act on this because they have that fourth pick available. So if they can identify which quarterback they like and come to an understanding or at least believe that that guy is not going to be gone at number four, then I think that they would definitely look into moving that pick. I mean, you look at this team and they've got four or five players that you would call core players, really talented young guys. And they've got an enormous amount of cap space. So I think what would make sense for them is to stockpile on above average, you know, future NFL starters, as opposed to, you know, drafting two guys there at the top and asking them to carry your franchise for the next year or so while you make gains in free agency. So I do think that they're pretty motivated to move that number one pick, but it just depends on which quarterback they settle on. You know, if they feel like, you know, Sam Darnold is the guy and there's no way that he gets past the Giants at two, then I don't think they move that pick.
I was going to say, how big of a drop-off do you think there is if they keep that number four pick overall from number one at quarterback?
Well, I think at the other positions, you guarantee you're probably not going to get Saquon Barkley at running back, right? But, you know, I don't think that that's their priority right now. At quarterback, you figure the Giants are in the market. And with the Colts at three, that's another huge decision that a team has to make in terms of trading. Because it could be that the Broncos or the Dolphins or even the Chargers or the Saints fall in love with somebody at the top of the draft here to play quarterback and then give the Colts the deal of a lifetime to move up to that spot. So, you know, I think if you're Cleveland, you may be even entertaining the idea of moving back to three and giving the Colts the opportunity to draft the position player that they're enamored with.
We're talking to Robert Klemko, doing so for another few moments. I got to ask you, Robert, back in the day, you used to go to Raider games with your grandmother. What memories do you have of those games and the game day experience in Oakland?
Oh, my God. You know, it's one thing that I'm really going to miss because, you know, I grew up going to Raiders games. My grandma actually went to the first Raiders game in 1960, so she's a diehard.
Wow.
She's 85 years old now and still flies out to a game every year. So I don't know if she's going to still do that in Las Vegas, but when she took us to games in Oakland, we always would stay at the hotel that the players would stay at, and we would always kind of hang out, especially after wins, around like the bar area, the restaurant area at the Airport Hilton over on Hagenberger Road. And every once in a while, after a win, you could catch John Gruden stumbling out of the bar or his private hotel room, you know, to a car being driven by some other member of his family. But I just always loved seeing how John embraced that community and how much he celebrated and how much he cared about the wins. So I think it's awesome that he's back there in that town. I think that town kind of gave him his aura and gave him his identity, that Chucky identity. So, you know, I don't know if my grandma's going to go back to games in Las Vegas, but I know I'll be excited to go.
I was going to say, my biggest takeaway from that story is not how cool Gruden is, but how cool your grandmother is. How awesome that she would take you to games and still goes once a year. Listen, last thought. I want to shift away from football for a moment to address something else that I think impacts everybody. You are one of the most respected members of the media, but according to something I saw on Twitter, you were somehow boarding Group C, boarding position 62 on a Southwest flight recently. How is that possible, and where did you end up sitting?
Well, this actually plays nicely into what I'm working on. I'm doing a story on Baker Mayfield. Now, I've been doing a weekly series on him. So part of that is interviewing different people around the league. I talked to Daryl Bevel for a story, the former Seahawks coordinator, on how Baker compared to Russell Wilson. So this week, coming out of the combine, I wanted to kind of debrief Baker, and the only opportunity to do that was to ride with him from the hotel to the airport. And so I had to find out what time his flight was and, you know, get it all set with his people. And then by the time that I bought that ticket, it was the same day. So my check-in was pretty late.
Hey, listen, I see what you're doing here. I can't get enough of this guy. I've been reading everything you've been writing about him. Is he on board? Is he participating? What's he think of this whole series?
Yeah, you know, I think he's participating, you know, as well as you would expect anybody to. He's extremely busy. I mean, not only does he go to the combine and have to deal with the interviews and the testing and all that, but, you know, Nike and Adidas are vying for his services, and that's a real bidding war right there. So it's kind of like college football recruiting in a lot of ways. So he's busy, and that's why I've tried to branch out and talk to people that aren't Baker, that aren't associated with Baker, who can give a good perspective on him. You know, we went into this series thinking, you know, we might dig something up and then he might be turned off to it and not participate at all. And as I've said on other shows, you know, we did our due diligence. We requested police reports, anything involving Baker Mayfield from the six different places he's lived since he was 14 years old, fully expecting, you know, that we might find something that hadn't been reported, the way these teams are trying to find things. But we just hadn't found anything. And I think it speaks to, you know, his character and just what everybody that knows him says about him, is that that one arrest in 2017 was something of an anomaly and something that he deeply regrets, and something he's been trying to convince all these teams of for the last 3 months does not define him.
Yeah, I was going to say, then as a quick follow, coming into the combine, my man, your alarm's going off again.
Sorry about that.
Hey, Robert, you didn't set that thing like to wake up at 11 o'clock Pacific, did you?
No, actually, I think it's Twitter. I got to turn my notifications off.
Okay, you know, really quickly. So, if you're digging and not necessarily looking, but you're digging and nothing's coming up. Going into the combine, he wanted to make it really clear, look, I'm not the next Johnny Manziel. Now that he's been there and nothing is coming out, do you think that that rap that he's the next Manziel is dead amongst NFL teams now? Are they beyond that?
You know, I think that they've – a lot of teams that have put in the work there have been beyond that for a long time because, you know, you can get a scout pretty much to tell you whatever the group think is, right? So if I'm talking to the Northeast or Mid-Atlantic area scout about Baker Mayfield, he hasn't been at the school, and he may not even have a relationship with the Southwest area scout, and he sees that Baker is a little bit flip at the Senior Bowl, and he says, oh, that guy reminds me a lot of Johnny Manziel, right? But does that mean that's the opinion of the organization? I think a lot of times these scouts are very disconnected from one another. And while one scout who has that area, who's been working that kid and trying to figure out who that kid is for 2 years and been at that school every other week in the fall will have one opinion, and then some other scout who hasn't been around will have a completely different opinion. And when all the teams get together after the combine, then I think you really start to get a sense for how the organization feels about a guy. And you're right. You didn't hear anything negative coming out of the combine, which I think Baker has to take as a positive thing.
The NFL scouting combine was not the only place where yoked up, shredded dudes were throwing around insane amounts of iron this past weekend. The 17th annual Arnold, as in Schwarzenegger, the 17th annual Arnold Strongman Classic went down in Columbus. And I'm here to tell you, this thing did not disappoint. Now, you already knew when you put a bunch of gym guys into a convention center that it's going to get weird. I mean, all those roids, all those dudes seeing who can carry the biggest water jug or sip the protein shake the longest. But when you get all of those dudes in the same room to watch the real dudes do work, then things go from 0 to 60 in about 3 grunts. Which leads me to my hero, Mikhail Shivliakov. The Mick is trying to run down the legends. Brian Shaw, the defending classic champ, 6'8", 420-pound monster who's been glossed the Gigantor. 6'9", 420-pound Half-Thor Bjornsson, the mountain from the Game of Thrones. A 6'9", 420-pounder from Iceland, who is widely considered the world's strongest man. He's trying to run down guys like that. The Mick wants to be one of them. So, my man, and if you're watching on CBS Sports Network, you're going to see this. He stands over a bar with 939 pounds of iron strapped to it, 426 kilos in gym guy talk. And my man goes all freaking in.
Come on! Wow. For 1 second, I thought y'all went to sleep. I see you're still awake.
I would say that's a maximum effort.
We do have a cleanup on aisle 9.
A cleanup on aisle 9 because dude's face exploded everywhere. The audio does not do it justice. Straight fire from his nose holes. This guy's face exploded. He blew his face out. Straight up blew his face out. I mean, there's maxing out, and then there's going double-barreled geysers of blood out of your nose. Geysers. Dude was going double-barrel geysers. If you can't see it, that's how that went down. This guy was hemorrhaging from his face in the middle of the lift with nearly a G-note of steel on his elephant bar deadlift. The Mick's legs were wobbling. His spine looked like it was going to be a toothpick in half. And then he nearly sent his brain right through his nose. But hey, my man locked it out.
I would say that's a maximum effort.
That was a maximum effort. You think? The dude just turned his nostrils into garden spigots, all to get nearly a half of ton of iron a few feet off the ground. And it still wasn't even enough to win the event. Look, I'm not here to call my guy out. I'm not here to call the mix soft. But if you're at 939 pounds, what's another 61? If you're going to turn your face into a snuff film, at least do it with a comma on that bar. On second thought, I think I do know what another 61 is. Probably some cranial tissue turtle heading out of his nose, or his ears turning into side sprayers. If pain is just weakness leaving the body, my man's just fire hydranted all sorts of pain down his face, through his face, coming right out of his face. But my man locked it out. He did. He got the steel back on the ground. And then he got a towel for his grill and a third place medal around his neck. What a freaking warrior. Love the Mick. This guy was willing to explode his face in pursuit of a gurr. Somebody get this dude a protein shake and some and some nose plugs. There's another Max Day right around the corner. You have to see his video. It's incredible. My man's face exploded.
We do have a cleanup on aisle 9.
Why? Because my man's face exploded. Mick, you're a boss, bro. Dude, you are awesome. Good enough for third, though. Good enough for third. Someone call someone. My man's face exploded on aisle 3. This is not the only weightlifter who's in the news. Breaking news and credit. Let me just let that breathe for a minute. Let me let that breathe because I know my man's not going to breathe through his nose ever again. His face exploded. Good job, Mick. Well done. You made it. Breaking news from the NFL in terms of weightlifting. Referee Ed Hockley is retiring from the NFL. That just in. After 28 years. The 67-year-old is calling it a day. The gun show, hanging up the medium stripes. The left-hander is taking his yellow flag and his dumbbell set and curling off into the sunset. And I'm pretty sure that the dude who gave us our buttocks drop,
buttocks,
is still explaining the overtime rules.
With the score tied. And at the end of regulation, we'll go into overtime. There are special overtime rules in the playoffs. Both teams get an opportunity to possess the football with one exception. That one exception is that a touchdown always wins the game. So if the team that gets the opening kickoff scores a touchdown on their first possession, the game is over at that point. If the team that first gets the ball kicks a field goal, the other team will have an opportunity to possess the football, and then we are essentially in sudden death. If the first team that gets the football does not score, we will go into sudden death. The second team will then have the opportunity to possess the ball. And the first team to score, even if it's just by 3 points, will win. Timing rules.
In order to get a first down, you must go 10 yards. If you get 5 yards on first down, you need an additional 5 yards to secure the first down. You have 4 downs to get the first down. The football field is 100 yards. If you kick the football through the goalposts, you will get 3 points, unless you do it after a touchdown, and then it is 1 point. If you choose not to try to get 1 point, you can attempt to get 2 points. Buttocks. Monday is Arms Day. Look, here's the good news, and not just that they're ripping that mic away from his mouth and keeping him away from a mic. The good news is the Hockley name is not getting out of the officiating biz. Ed's son, Sean, just got promoted. So we're still in business. He's moving up from back judge to ref. And if you're asking, the kid wears long sleeves and his bicep game, nothing, not yet, but nothing compared to that of his old man. Hey, listen, that is not a tough act to follow. Or that is a tough act to follow. I don't know if I want to walk in those shoes. This guy is going to have to step his game up. That is the epitome of step your game up. Something has to change. Sean, my man, you need to step your game up because your old man changed the game. He turned penalties into pose downs. Every first down became a chance to take fans to the gun show. Every illegal man downfield, a chance to flex, the buys and the tries, and to trap some fools. Sean, you got to do that old man proud. Put down the rule book, get to the curl bar. You've got 6 months to do right by the family name. There are no shortcuts. And most of all, no days off. No days off. Do the work. Do your job. No shortcuts. That stadium is not going to bench press itself. Buttocks. I'm going to miss that guy. Steve Lavin joins us. Steve, it's good to have you on the show. How are you?
Great to be with you, Jim. It's been too long. Miss you.
It has been too long. Steve, great to hear your voice. Nice to have you. Let me ask you, it's the Tuesday, Steve, before the selection show. As I mentioned, you led eight teams to the NCAA tournament. So what's this week like for head coaches of teams that are on the bubble? And then what's it like, Steve, for teams that are battling for seeding?
Well, that's a good question. You know, if you're coaching teams that are on the bubble, you're just trying to focus on the things you have control over. So you're really locked in on your upcoming opponent because, you know, if you win and advance in these conference tournaments, you really take the decision or the uncertainty out of the equation. And you take the decision out of the selection committee's hands and you put yourself squarely in the NCAA tournament by earning the old-fashioned way the right to play in the tournament by getting W's. If you already know you're in the tournament, it's about momentum. And it's about, you know, cleaning things up, refining, kind of, you know, fine-tuning certain aspects of play. And there's a balance because you also want your team fresh mentally and physically when they step into the tournament. So you're also aware of tapering back on the amount of time, the workload of practices and the film sessions, the walkthroughs, what we call the skull sessions, the mental preparation. But again, it's a fine line. It's not a science, but I think it's a feel. Coaches that have been there before, that have experience, just like jockeys in horse racing, that know how to close, know how to finish, and have a real pulse for their team in terms of where they're at. Are they fatigued? Do they need to, get on the floor to work in certain aspects of play, or could you kind of make sure that you're at full strength and rested as you step into the tournament?
We are talking to Steve Lavin. You know, Steve, you were in the press room at the University of Arizona before Sean Miller's press conference last week. What have you made of everything that's unfolded surrounding the Arizona program the past few weeks?
Well, they're really an interesting study. I mean, you talk about high drama, what they've been through as a basketball team and as a basketball program this year. From the early, firing of an assistant coach on their staff, and then Raleigh Alkins being injured in November and December, missing games. That's where they lost their three games down in Atlantis, three consecutive games. And then Alonzo Trier later was suspended and then reinstated because of an NCAA issue with drug testing. And then Sean Miller, most recently, who was really prosecuted in the public and in the media and because of the wiretap information that was somehow revealed to the media. And so he was suspended but then returned. And I think it could actually be a galvanizing force for this Arizona team. They have potentially four first-round draft picks. I think they have the number one draft pick in Ayton, but also we talked about Trier and Alkins. And what's interesting with this team, they probably have two losses if they had been at full strength all season. If you look at those three losses in Atlantis without Alkins, you look at the Oregon loss most recently without Trier, and if they had two losses, they'd be number one or two in the country in a one or a two seed. But because of those struggles that they've had, people are looking at them as a 4 or 5 seed, and I think they'd be as dangerous a 4 or 5 seed as we've seen in recent years. So I also just feel that sometimes when you go through that adversity, it rallies a team. to enhance or elevate their level of play. And I think that group has really rallied around Sean Miller because of the type of experience he went through these past couple weeks.
Steve Lavin, my guest. Steve, before I let you go, let me ask you about one more coach. I had Tony Bennett on the show yesterday, and we were talking about the success that he's had at Virginia. As you'd expect, he's very humble about it. But when you look at the fact that he's won three regular season ACC titles in 5 years, going up against monsters like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, how impressed are you with the job that he's done?
Well, for starters, when you look at Tony Bennett, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. His father, Dick Bennett, one of the great coaches in the history of basketball, a Hall of Famer. He coached at every level, old-fashioned in his approach in terms of working at his craft of teaching and coaching. Very similar to Bo Ryan, and interestingly enough, when you look at Tony Bennett, he worked under Bo Ryan at Wisconsin as well. So he's been influenced by some of the Mount Rushmore coaches, and in particular on the defensive side of the ball and offensively taking care of the basketball and understanding the importance of shot selection. And when you take care of the ball, you don't turn it over, and you work for great shots, that's what really sets up your defense, because teams never get good runouts off of your turnovers or off of bad shots. He's one of the best in the business, and I think he brings a new twist. He's obviously younger, so he really is someone that believes in all the old-fashioned kind of fundamentals of the game, the virtues and values of toughness and togetherness, and all those things that sound cliche or like coach speak, but they live those out, those virtues and values of basketball. They believe in them. It's like the sacraments when it comes to the Bennett family, and that's why they've been so successful. And they also play a style that unnerves opponents, really discombobulates them. They get to the central nervous system of opponents because of the way they approach things defensively and because they're disciplined at both ends of the floor. That's why they've had great success. They dictate tempo. They impose their preferred will, their preferred style of play on opponents. Those are the teams that are a handful to deal with when you step into the postseason.
But you best believe when the kid from Home Alone absolutely burns the New England Patriots to the ground, I'm going to double back and hit it. So let me set this up very quickly. Sometime around the third hour of the Oscars broadcast, the award for best original score was being given out. And when Alexander Desplat was announced as the winner, most people took to Twitter to rightfully say it should have been Johnny Greenwood. Because probably it should have been Johnny Greenwood. Everybody knows that, which is why everybody said it should have been Johnny Greenwood. Enter child star of the 90s, Macaulay Culkin, who came off the top rope with his take of the night and the surprise nuke of the night. Quote, actually, the best original score of the year was New England 33, Philadelphia 41. Straight freaking Home Alone fire. Damn, son. First off, did anybody know the Culk was still alive? We're still working. We're still tweeting. We're still doing anything at all. The last time I saw this kid, he overslept his wake-up call for a family vacation. Come on! There's out of nowhere, and then there's Macaulay Culkin out of nowhere. And I've got to say, the worst part of losing the Super Bowl for the Pats happened on Sunday night when freaking Macaulay Culkin dropped the Phantom Grenade. I mean, one thing for Mark from Hollywood to dance all over the Pats' grave. Entirely another, though, for the Culk, formerly from Hollywood, to do it on Twitter to the tune of 8,500 repops and 23,000 likes. I mean this in the best possible way. Look what you did, you little jerk.
Look what you did, you little jerk.
Let me read that tweet one more time. Quote, actually, the best original score of the year was New England 33, Philadelphia 41. Notice the egregious sports faux pas of putting the losing score first. How many times has your wife done that? Hey, who won that game? Who won the football game? Who won the high school football game? Oh, we did. 7-14. all the time, right? I mean, this just makes that tweet so much better. Because if Kevin from Home Alone really isn't that big of a fan, then this is troll level infinity squared. Dude messed up the format of the score. You gotta love that, right? You don't know that more wins. You put the team that scored more points first. He messed up the format of that. But that just makes it that much more awesome of a get over. Not to mention that that joke could have been written a month ago, knowing full well it was going to play as soon as best score was announced. Imagine that kid sitting on that kind of fire for that long, waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and jonesing and wanting it so badly and waiting. Well played, Kolk. Well played. Even Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern feel badly for the Pats. Right about now. All right, so let's do a little word association. If I want to say something, and you tell me the first thing that pops into your mind, all right? We've done this before. This game's always fun. I'm going to say a word or a phrase, and no matter where you are, you blurt out the very first thing that comes to mind. I'll even do it with you. All right, so wherever you are right now, if you're in your car, if you're at home, if you're at the office, if you've got a pair of headphones on, I will say something, and you blurt out the first thing that comes to mind. Are you ready? Here goes. Macaulay Culkin, adult alarm. Am I right?
Molly!
Am I right?
Get dressed! They're in!
Remember this?
Get your underwears on!
Am I right? That's a fun game, right? Okay, thanks, Alvy. I think we got it. There it is, clones. Podcast Tuesday has now morphed into Podcast Wednesday, at least for this week, but it'll be worth it. I'll be talking to two-time gold medalist David Wise tomorrow. Check that out, and I will see you then.